Imagine a narrow stretch of water. It is barely 21 miles wide at its absolute narrowest point.
Right, which is incredibly small when you think about it.
Exactly. Now imagine that someone just hovering their foot over that water has the power to instantly trigger a global recession. I mean, they could spike the price of gas in your hometown and basically force the United States military into a standoff that it just cannot shoot its way out of.
It completely upends our traditional understanding of power. Because, we are so conditioned to look at a military conflict like it's a simple math problem.
Yeah, like a scoreboard.
Right. You count the fighter jets, you tally up the interceptor missiles, and you just assume that the side with the bigger numbers dictates the outcome.
But the strategic landscape we are diving into today renders that kind of scoreboard essentially meaningless. So, welcome to this deep dive. Today, we are unpacking a highly detailed stack of source material that you requested.
And it is a fascinating stack of documents.
It really is. It's a comprehensive policy-level assessment of a hypothetical U.S.-Iran conflict. And the date on this assessment is today, June 6, 2026.
The intelligence and data you provided pull from a really serious array of institutions. We are looking at situational analyses from the American newspaper and American TV.
Yep, plus a lot of raw data.
Exactly. Raw data and reporting from CNTCOM, Reuters, the Center for Strategic and International Studies, RAND, the International Energy Agency, and the Sufan Center.
So our mission for this deep dive is to look past the breaking news alerts, all those headlines about tactical strikes and drone
The
intercepts.
flashy stuff.
Right, the flashy stuff. We want to uncover the underlying mechanics of this battlefield because the real contest here isn't about firepower at all. It is a grueling test of political endurance and global economics.
And just to be absolutely clear for you listening, we are acting purely as neutral analysts today. We will impartially explore the political and military objectives of both Washington and Tehran exactly as they are laid out in these sources.
No taking sides here.
Right. We are not taking a political stance, and we are not endorsing either side's viewpoint. Our only goal is to give you a purely objective understanding of the strategic landscape, just mapping out the geopolitical reality as these think tanks and intelligence agencies report it.
I appreciate that disclaimer. So,
Okay.
mapping out that territory, the most glaring dynamic right out of the gate is the immense disparity in conventional military strength.
Oh, it's staggering.
It is. The sources explicitly state that the United States has overwhelming conventional superiority, high-end air power, unmatched naval reach, incredibly advanced missile defense.
If this were a conventional force-on-force war, the U.S. would just dominate.
Which begs the question, if the U.S. dominates the airspace and the sea, why don't they just neutralize the threat and enforce a quick victory?
It's the logical next question.
Right. And reading through the CNTCOM data, I kept coming back to this analogy. It is like an arm wrestling match where one person is undeniably stronger.
Okay, it's like this.
You look at them and you know they can slam the other person's hand to the table in a second. But the weaker person has their foot hovering right over the power cord to the entire building.
That captures the asymmetric leverage perfectly. Because the objective of the person with their foot over the cord isn't to win the arm wrestling match.
They know they can't.
Right, they know they can't. Their objective is to make the stronger person realize that applying enough force to win the match will just plunge the entire building into darkness.
So, military pressure alone doesn't actually translate to political success. The sources describe this as a loop of shock without settlement.
Yes, the strategic logic matrix in the documents outlines this clearly. What's fascinating here is that you can achieve a high tactical effect.
Right, like blowing up radar sites.
Exactly. You can destroy radar sites, intercept drones, crater runways, but you get incredibly weak political conversion from that. You cannot turn those smoking craters into a signed peace treaty.
Because Tehran's core objective isn't some grand military triumph over U.S. forces, it is regime survival.
And they achieve that survival by pulling Washington into this endurance contest. They want to prove they can deny the United States a clean, quick victory by making the conflict prohibitively expensive.
And regionally contagious. Let's actually lay out what Washington wants out of this, because it's important to remember they aren't looking for a total war either.
Not at all.
According to the assessment, the U.S. wants to roll back Iran's nuclear threat, preserve freedom of navigation, reassure their Gulf partners, and absolutely avoid getting dragged into a major ground war.
So They are trying to achieve a controlled, coercive outcome. That is the exact phrase. They want to use violence as a precisely calibrated dial, turning it up just enough to compel a change in Iran's behavior, but without breaking the region.
But wait, if the U.S. intelligence apparatus knows that Iran's entire strategy is to drag this out into an expensive, messy endurance contest, why play their game?
What do you mean?
Well, if you have the overwhelming firepower, why not dial it up to maximum immediately? Just destroy the capabilities threatening the region and force an end to the standoff.
Well, that is the core constraint of a superpower operating in a globalized economy. If the U.S. uses maximum unrestricted firepower, yes, they will undoubtedly destroy Iranian military capabilities.
Right.
But in doing so, they practically guarantee that Tehran responds with everything they have, which spirals the conflict across the entire Middle East.
Ah, okay.
And that violates Washington's primary goals, which are protecting those Gulf partners and keeping the global economy stable. The harder Washington punches, the more they risk damaging the very stability they are trying to protect.
Which brings us to exactly how Iran makes this endurance contest so incredibly expensive. And it all comes back to that 21-mile stretch of water, the Strait of Hormuz.
It is the ultimate geographic leverage.
The baseline data provided by the International Energy Agency, the IEA, puts this into really sharp perspective. The Strait handles roughly 20 million barrels per day of seaborne oil trade.
Which is a massive number.
It's about a quarter of all global seaborne oil trade, plus 19% of the world's seaborne LNG trade.
And the critical mechanical detail here from the visual data is the bypass capacity.
What does that mean exactly?
Well, the pipelines that allow energy exporters to completely skip the strait and get their oil straight to the open ocean, those pipelines can only handle about 3.5 to 5.5 million barrels per day.
Wait, really? Only up to 5.5 million?
Exactly. The physical infrastructure to reroute that massive 20 million barrels simply does not exist.
Wow. You know, I always hear about the threat of Iran just closing the strait, but realistically, they don't have the naval power to build a literal wall of ships and block the U.S. Navy from entering, do they?
No, of course not. And they don't need to physically barricade it. The leverage is entirely about generating what maritime analysts call maritime risk.
So what does this all mean? Walk me through the actual mechanism of that. Let's say the U.S. decides to keep the energy flowing. The U.S. Navy is massive. Why can't they just put a guided missile destroyer next to every single commercial oil tanker and physically escort them through?
It really comes down to logistics and asymmetric warfare. First off, there are simply too many commercial vessels and not nearly enough warships to provide dedicated escorts for all of them.
I guess that makes sense.
But more importantly, a U.S. destroyer is incredibly capable. It can defend against a lot, but it cannot guarantee zero damage against a massive swarm of explosive drones or fast attack craft or naval mines operating in such a confined waterway.
And I imagine commercial shipping companies don't really care if there's a warship nearby, if a cheap drone can still punch a hole in their hull.
Exactly the point. The mechanism of maritime risk operates primarily through the insurance market.
Insurance markets.
Yeah, when an area like the Persian Gulf becomes highly volatile, maritime insurers designated a high-risk zone. So the insurance premiums for a single voyage can jump from a tiny fraction of a percent of the ship's value to over 1% or more.
Oh, wow.
Suddenly, a routine transit costs millions of dollars more just in insurance premiums.
So what does that trigger? Does the logistics chain just start breaking down?
Yes. Ship owners start mandating dark shipping. They force captains to turn off their tracking transponders to hide from targeting.
Which makes the entire global logistics chain blind.
Right. And eventually, major shipping conglomerates look at the skyrocketing insurance costs and the physical danger, and they simply issue transit halts. They just refuse to sail.
And that is how a localized threat thousands of miles away hits you at home. I mean, a disruption in the strait means an immediate global supply shock. The cost to manufacture and ship everyday goods jumps, global inflation surges, and the price of gas at your local pump skyrocket.
That's the conversion mechanism. They take localized military pressure from the U.S. and convert it into global economic pain.
They're weaponizing the global economy.
Yes, they know that if energy markets panic, importing nations in Asia, European allies, and everyday global consumers will furiously pressure Washington to de-escalate and stabilize the markets. They are effectively outsourcing their deterrence to the global economy.
Okay, let's unpack this, because this brings up a terrifying chain reaction in the region. If the global economy is taking a hit, that external pressure inevitably bleeds into the domestic politics and regional alliances on the ground.
It illustrates the extreme fragility of the situation.
The intelligence assessments map out this escalation ladder, and it doesn't take much at all. You start with minor ceasefire violations, you know, small skirmishes that don't really make international headline.
Right, low-level stuff.
But if those aren't contained, suddenly a commercial tanker gets hit. Now, maritime disruption is active. But how does a hit on a commercial tanker force a broader regional war, though? What is the mechanical link that pushes this into neighboring countries?
The link is the geography of U.S. basing. When the U.S. responds to a maritime attack, they have to launch aircraft and logistics support from their regional bases.
And those bases are in the Gulf states.
Exactly. They are hosted by Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Qatar, Kuwait. When Iran wants to raise the cost on Washington, they don't just target the U.S. military directly. They pressure those host nations.
So the Gulf states are caught squarely in the crossfire. They host the U.S. bases, but they share the neighborhood with Iran.
And their vulnerability is extreme here. These states are currently attempting massive economic transitions. They're building sovereign wealth funds, massive global aviation hubs, international tourism sectors.
Like Dubai and Doha.
Yes, and all of those ambitions rely entirely on the perception of stability. If Iranian actions or proxy attacks start causing civilian disruption or economic damage in their territory, their entire economic futures are at risk.
So they might privately want Washington to get tough on Iran, but publicly, they desperately need de-escalation so their economies don't just collapse.
That's the tension. Mm. And looking at the RAND and CSIS reporting, there's another massive complication in the alliance structure here, specifically regarding Israel.
Right, because the definition of an acceptable resolution is entirely different depending on who you ask.
The divergence in strategic priorities is stark. Washington is primarily focused on maintaining global energy flows, protecting those Gulf bases, and managing superpower credibility without triggering a sprawling war.
But Israel's focus is totally different.
It's fundamentally existential. They are looking at the immediate threat of Iran's ballistic missile forces and the heavily armed Hezbollah proxy networks positioned right on their northern border.
So Washington and Israel are nominally aligned against Tehran, but a deal that looks like a victory to the U.S., say, stabilizing the oil markets and securing the shipping lanes, well, that might leave the proxy missile threat against Israel completely intact.
Which heavily complicates any attempt by Washington to negotiate a durable ceasefire. Because easing the pressure on Iran to save the global economy might embolden the proxies threatening Israel, creating a totally separate vector for the conflict to explode.
Wow. And meanwhile, as all these regional clocks are ticking, the domestic clock in Washington is ticking very loudly. The reporting from Reuters, again, dated today, June 2026, highlights a massive warning indicator for U.S. political endurance.
This is a critical data point.
It really is. The House of Representatives held a vote on a war powers resolution aimed at explicitly limiting the president's freedom to continue military operations in Iran without congressional authorization.
And the margin on that vote was 215 to 208.
A 7-vote margin. It is razor thin. So we have a U.S. president facing intense congressional pushback and an electorate that is furious about domestic inflation.
Right.
And we have an Iranian regime facing deep economic fragility and relentless sanctions. Under that much mutual crushing pressure, isn't a massive miscalculation almost guaranteed? I mean, doesn't someone eventually panic and just launch a preemptive strike?
Well, it is a very common assumption, but the strategic assessments point to a different, perhaps more insidious risk. The highest probability of a broader war doesn't actually stem from a deliberate, dramatic decision in a war room to launch a massive first strike.
It doesn't. So what triggers the slide?
The cumulative effect of limited, ambiguous actions. The primary mechanism for miscalculation here is imperfect attribution.
Imperfect attribution, meaning you know you got hit, but you can't immediately prove who pulled the trigger.
Precisely. Iran relies heavily on proxy forces in Lebanon, Iraq, Syria, and Yemen. They use these groups to project power and create a buffer of deniability.
Right, the deniability factor.
So imagine an explosive drone hits a critical Gulf oil facility. Mm. The drone flew from Iraqi airspace, but it's an Iranian design. Who do you retaliate against?
Right, because if the U.S. hits Iran directly, they risk triggering the massive regional war they are trying to avoid. But if they only hit the proxy group in Iraq, they risk alienating the Iraqi government and failing to establish real deterrence against Tehran.
And that hesitation is exactly what Tehran weaponizes. But the danger is that proxy groups have their own localized agendas.
They aren't totally controlled.
No. So if a proxy goes rogue or miscalculates, and launches an attack that kills a large number of U.S. service members or allied civilians, the U.S. might suddenly gain the domestic political mandate for an overwhelming, devastating military response.
Ah, I see.
The real miscalculation is a slow, messy slide into a total war that neither side actually drafted a plan to fight.
Which brings us to the most difficult part of this entire scenario. How do they actually step off this escalation ladder? The assessment lays out the conditions for what a victory, or at least a survival state, looks like for both sides.
Right. So the baseline for a U.S. strategic victory rests on three pillars: implementing a verified limitation on Iran's nuclear program, restoring credible maritime access through the strait, and driving global oil prices back down to politically manageable levels.
And Iran's win state, how they endure, is vastly different. They claim success if they keep maritime risk alive as a credible threat, maintain their active proxy networks, and force some level of economic sanctions relief, all while avoiding a regime-ending retaliation.
And then there's the mutual loss scenario, which is devastating for everyone.
Right. They both lose if this spirals. Major regional infrastructure is destroyed, civilian casualties mount, the global shipping crisis becomes permanent, and inflation runs unchecked. The U.S. might win the tactical military engagements, sure, but would lose strategic control of the region.
And Iran might physically survive, but would be left totally isolated and economically ruined.
Preventing that mutual loss requires an off-ramp.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the anatomy of a limited ceasefire in this environment is incredibly complex. It requires a phased approach.
Okay.
You need monitored nuclear restraints, a staged release of limited frozen funds, perhaps specifically earmarked for humanitarian imports, and a verified halt in high-risk maritime interference.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Looking at the geopolitics, why can't they just use back channels to sync this up? Like, why not just agree to implement all those steps simultaneously?
Because of the profound deficit of trust between the two, which creates what the analysts identify as the sequencing problem.
The sequencing problem. It's a psychological roadblock as much as a political one, isn't it? Washington refuses to give front-loaded financial concessions. They absolutely will not release frozen funds first, because they believe those funds are their only real leverage to force nuclear compliance.
Right. If they hand over the money, they lose the carrot.
Exactly. But from Tehran's perspective, their ability to harass the Strait of Hormuz is their strongest bargaining chip. They refuse to give up their maritime threat first, because without that threat hanging over the global economy, they have no way to force Washington to actually deliver on the financial relief.
The Hormuz first.
Right. Releasing funds first looks like paying ransom to the U.S. public, which the administration cannot afford given that 215 to 208 war powers vote. But stepping down the maritime threat first looks like capitulation to Iranian hardliners.
Which leads directly to the executive judgment for the immediate 30-day outlook based on this June 2026 data. The forecast is not a grand diplomatic breakthrough.
What is it then?
The outlook is volatile containment.
So we're stuck in the loop.
We are. For the next month, the sources project a very fragile cycle. We will see intermittent, localized clashes that purposefully stay just below the threshold of full-scale war.
Wow.
We will see indirect negotiations filtered through regional mediators like Oman or Qatar. And above all, we will see intense, aggressive information warfare.
Because both sides are desperately fighting for the narrative. They both need an exit story that they can sell to their domestic audiences as a resounding victory.
We have covered a massive amount of incredibly dense strategic ground today.
We really have, and it is a lot to synthesize for you listening. So, just to recap what we've unpacked. Overwhelming military firepower is practically useless if you don't have the domestic political endurance to back it up.
Right.
Through the Strait of Hormuz, Iran utilizes asymmetric geography to turn a regional dispute into a global supply chain crisis. And the constant threat of imperfect attribution by proxy forces leaves the entire globe teetering on the edge of an accidental war.
You know, the complexity of engineering a diplomatic exit from that scenario raises a really fascinating question. It's something that lingered with me after reviewing the final pages of the analysis.
Oh, yeah. What stood out to you?
The sources emphasize that any successful limited ceasefire requires an off-ramp with a quote-unquote no public humiliation clause. Both Washington and Tehran need to walk away looking strong and resolute to their own people.
That makes sense in theory.
But consider the reality of the media environment we operate in today. We are in an era of open source intelligence, hyper-accelerated information warfare, and instant global communication.
Yeah, nothing stays secret.
Exactly. Every satellite image of a damaged base, every leaked diplomatic cable, every subtle shift in military posture is broadcast, analyzed, and spun worldwide in a matter of seconds.
It is virtually impossible to hide a concession or quietly sweep a compromise under the rug anymore.
So the provocative thought I want to leave you with is this. In a world where absolute transparency is often weaponized, is it even possible for two deeply entrenched, historically hostile powers to strike a complex geopolitical bargain without one side being publicly portrayed as humiliated?
That is a tough question.
Because the answer to that question of political psychology might ultimately dictate whether the global energy market stabilize or spiral entirely out of control.
A geopolitical standoff where the perception of strength is just as critical as the physical leverage itself. That is a profound angle to consider and a great note to end on. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the underlying mechanics of modern conflict. We'll catch you on the next one.